Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning, the 22nd of May. Our guest this hour says the transatlantic divide between European and U.S. retailers over how best to respond to fatal disasters in Bangladesh textile factories split wide open last week, with U.S. retailers claiming their European counterparts are giving labor unions too much control over ensuring workplace safety. Robert Ross is our guest, professor of sociology at Clark University and author of Slaves to Fashion. He's director of the International Studies Stream, and his major work has been on the globalization of capital and labor. He has been concentrating since 1994, his research and public speaking on the resurgence of sweatshop conditions in the American apparel industry and its relations to sweatshop conditions around the world. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Robert Ross during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Robert Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Let's start with that transatlantic divide, which you say split wide open last week. What is the divide?
About 38 European retailers have signed a binding agreement with a group of Bangladeshi and global labor union confederations and non-governmental organizations, NGOs. Which commit them to make contributions to fire safety, to create safety committees on which workers will be represented through their unions or, if there isn't a union, elected in the plant, in which disputes will be submitted to binding arbitration. Only two American retailers have signed on to the agreement, PVH, which owns Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein and Izod, and Abercrombie and Fitch. The two biggest elephants in the room on this are Walmart and The Gap. Walmart walked out of negotiations many months ago when the costs and the commitment became clear. The Gap stayed with the negotiations until almost the end, and they're saying they'd like to sign, but they're concerned about how binding it is.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, this, it seems to me, is terribly embarrassing, even humiliating for the North American retail community, the United States one in particular. Because the Europeans include low-cost discount marketers that are very similar to Walmart. H&M, CNA, Primark are among them. So what is really beneath this, from one surmises, especially from Walmart's point of view, is, first of all, what they claim, that they're concerned about how binding it is, and second, their long-term aversion to empowering workers, which is a terribly important and safety-related part of the agreement.
And tell me, what is the concern about the legally binding nature of the accord? What worries these companies about legally binding?
Well, what they've said is that if there's a dispute about what needs to be done with the money or whether a place is safe or not, it would go to arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, the company would lose its discretion, basically, and at that moment, it would no longer be able to bargain. It would have to do what the arbitrator says. So one surmises that they are averse to losing control.
Walmart has said, as I'm sure you know, that it began checking the 279 factories that supply its stores. It plans to inspect all of them within 6 months. What's wrong with that?
So, Kathleen, this is a retake on a strategy of corporate self-auditing, self-monitoring, which has been going on, depending on how you count, for almost 20 years, if we start with the Kathy Lee Gifford affair of child labor or the El Monte slave labor case in 1995, in which firms promulgate codes of conduct, and then they say, these are the standards to which we hold ourselves and our suppliers, and we will audit ourselves and our suppliers to make sure that we are in compliance with our own ethical code, and which include worker safety. Now, we've been through this, yay, these 20 years, and in studies of, in particular, fires in Bangladesh, what we find is, first of all, a 20-plus-year history of cataclysmic fires. This collapse at Rana Plaza on April 24th, which, of course, is an order of magnitude higher than other disasters, follows a history, for example, of 112 deaths in November of 2012 at the Tazreen Fashions factory, follows a factory collapse in 2005, follows other fires, in fact, including the recent one, there's about 2,100 deaths in 20-some-odd years from about 1,000 fires and collapses in Bangladesh. This is a horrific record. My students and I have studied the high mortality incidents since 2000. There's about 7 of them which have mortalities of more than 20 or so. Every single one of these fires supplied a European or a North American retailer that had a code of conduct that says, we are committed to worker health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that this is a dog that won't hunt. It's been tried. It's not working. And Walmart says, rather than commit ourselves to something for which there's actually consequences for ourselves, once again, we're going to say, we want to do the right thing. We're going to hire people to tell us whether we're doing the right thing. And we're going to do our best, period. That's the approach they've done for 20 years. It's not working.
Walmart also refused to clarify whether they sourced any of their clothes from the Rana Plaza building. They said it had no authorized production at the site. No authorized production. What does that mean?
These big firms, as your question implies, hire intermediaries to find factories for them, and they make a contract with a factory. And those contracts are for a certain quantity at a certain time. Often, the bidder for the contract finds that the factory cannot meet the quantity/time deadline. For whatever reason, they bid incorrectly or sometimes even with a conscious deception, but at any rate, they can't make it. So they subcontract some portion of what is necessary to another factory. That is, in the contracts that they write, that is often requires approval of the principal. And the factory owners don't always seek that approval. However, this is often also a dodge by the brand or the retailer, an evasion, because the brands, actually keep pretty careful track of where the stuff is coming from because they're terribly interested in quality control, bad sizing, bad stitching, bad hems, mm-hmm. bad buttonholes. These call for reworking, which is very costly. It boosts the cost of a garment quite a lot. So they don't want orders that have to be sent back. They don't want customers coming back to Walmart says, this says a medium, but the long sleeve shirt only goes up to my elbow. So they have agents who are always tracking the quality of the goods. Thus, one can't say they're always lying or deceiving the public when they say they didn't know. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that most of the time, it's highly probable that they know what's going on.
I would think that there would be so many consumers, particularly after this horrendous event where over 1,100 people lost their lives. It was just horrendous to watch. There would be enough people who would want to say, I really can't buy anything that has this on the label unless I know that it was made under safe working conditions, that consumers would be concerned about this, and it would behoove all of these people to sign on to agreements so consumers could feel a little better about this. Wouldn't that make sense?
It does make a little bit of sense. One of the reasons that we may see this difference between the scofflaw American retailers and the attempts from the European retailers to commit to a somewhat more regulated environment is that larger numbers of European consumers tell pollsters and such like that they're concerned about these matters. About 15% of American consumers say to survey researchers, and in some experiments actually behave that way, that they are concerned about this and are willing to pay a little bit more. But the retailers are so interested in cutthroat price competition, they have not really ventured into this. In the meantime, Kathleen, let's say you or some dear one to you took sincerely this conversation and said to him or herself, I don't want to buy something from Bangladesh till they clean that up.
Mm-hmm.
What would the person buy? It is impossible for me to say, as a student of the global apparel industry, that any country's label is sweat-free.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot give that aversion. It used to be that I could make such a contention about Italian clothes, A, which we can't afford, and B, they have had problems with counterfeit labels. Every place in the Western Hemisphere and Asia from which we now import clothes is rife with labor standards abuses.
What about clothes that say made in America?
Alas, they are now, of course, a very small fraction of our consumption. Under 10% of our consumption is made in America. There are some clothing brands that are union-made, for example, Hart Schafter and Marks in men's suits, that you can have confidence in. And there are some union-made T-shirts and ball caps and so on, New Era, for example. Apart from that, the rate of labor violation is gigantic. In the late 90s and early 2000s, 60% of cutting and sewing shops failed to pay minimum wage or overtime or both and had significant health and safety violations. In a more recent, now resumed study of conditions in Los Angeles, a cooperative study by California and the federal government found 100% of cutting and sewing shops had significant violations. These terrible results are related to the global situation. To stay in business making clothes in the United States, one faces this cutthroat competition from terrible conditions abroad. What's needed is some global regulation of the industry.
Mm-hmm. And why would it be that a larger number of Europeans are concerned about this issue than Americans?
Well, as a scientist, I can only speculate and make hypotheses, and if it's okay with you, I'll go ahead and do it.
Yeah, please.
First of all, their trade union movements are larger and take up more cultural space.
Mm.
We're under 7% in the private sector now. There aren't that many families that know somebody who's a member of a private sector union. Countries with 30-40% percentage, it's part of the culture, and labor standards are part of the language. And of course, they have political parties, social democratic parties, in or out of power, that take up much more space, and for which these concerns are more prominent. That's one hypothesis that is, it seems to me it's obvious, but I can't say I know it for a fact.
We welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in already. Robert Ross is our guest this hour. He's a professor of sociology at Clark University, author of Slaves to Fashion. And we're getting an update on the horrors of the Bangladesh fire and collapse of the building that took place about a month ago. There was an agreement that now U.S. retailers are backing out of, a Bangladesh safety agreement that has much more European support, but only two American retailers have said that they would go along with this. Why is that question? How important is a global agreement like this? Why is there more support from Europe than from the United States? And I think what Robert said is pretty dramatic here, that he cannot make any assurance that any country's label in the world was made under sweat-free conditions, any country in the world. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Julie in Mazamani. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm real good.
Good.
This conversation you're having this morning is so pertinent and important to me because I used to own a fair trade store, and I have actually traveled to many countries and purchased clothing directly from the people who actually were making the clothing. Mm. So with that said, I'm going to narrow it down to just one thought because I have a million. When I owned my store, I would see American consumers come into the shop, and they would look at something like a sweater that was made by hand by someone, and I would have a price of maybe $80 on it. And people would say, oh, $80, I could go to Walmart, and I could buy this for $15. And yet, at the same time, I see women walk into the high-end stores at malls and pay $180 for basically the same thing, and it says made in Bangladesh or made in China. So there is just such a disconnect in this country as to what really constitutes value and also the value that Americans place on some label, which honestly, you know, the store at the mall has maybe paid $5 or $10 for the sweater that they've then marked up to $180.
And then they put the darn label right on the front of the outfit, too. I've never understood that. Why are you not doing the business anymore, Julie? Was it not financially feasible?
Well, we lived in the state line area. We lived down in Rockton, Illinois. And when the grandchildren were born and we moved up to Mazamani, it's a little tough to run a business like that in Mazo. But we do still run actually a foreign language translation business. So I'm still very active on what goes on in other countries. But you know, the fair trade store is a little bit tough to run in a small town like this.
Mm-hmm. Robert Ross, what do you say?
Well, the fair trade model has pioneered some concepts that can be applied to this situation. While its origin is often in artisanal clothing production, small workshops and handcraft and so on, what the fair trade model has committed itself to is long-term relations to protect the producers from short-term volatility, and a large proportion of the producer's product being purchased by the fair trade entity. What that means is that whatever price premium the fair trade gives, it's actually spread over the whole production of the enterprise rather than just a portion of it. Now, this is very different from the typical structure in today's apparel industry. In any given factory, Walmart may have 30% of the production, some other company may have another 30% of the production, and so on. So if Walmart's competitor agrees to pay a little more per thousand in order to contribute to the factory owner's ability to make a safety remediation, that only covers 30% of the production cost. So where Walmart then gets a free ride, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm.
So those principles of long-term relationships and a large proportion of production are the opposite of today's production chain practices. And I'm hoping that out of this agreement will come some encouragement to concentrate on the part of these retailers any given factory is producing just for people who have signed on to that agreement. That will give the owners much more powerful incentives to actually do the remediation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There's one more thing that
sure.
your caller said that's fascinating, and it has to do with brand loyalty. I got to tell you a funny story.
Okay.
I was once at a hearing in the Massachusetts legislature where at that time the International Ladies Garment Workers Union representative was complaining about the cutthroat price competition in brassieres. And he held up one brassiere. This is a statehouse hearing. He held up one brassiere and he said, "This was made here in Fall River and it costs I don't know how much. And this same brassiere was made someplace else and it only costs a third of that. It's the same brassiere." And there's this guy holding up two brassieres in front of all the besuited, dark-suited state legislators. But the point is, that funny story aside, what these brands have is a investment in their, let's call it their personas. And people will pay to wear the brand. Ralph Lauren, Donna Karan,
right.
Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger. Identical items with different labels will sell for very different things because people have been persuaded that these labels have some psycho-emotional signaling that they care to participate in. And people who aren't vulnerable to it, they go no logo and buy what they buy. But people who are vulnerable to it are trapped in this contradiction that your caller suggests, where they'll pay quite a premium for a label that, on the other hand, without the logo, is available much less expensively.
It is so strange, isn't it? Human behavior is so strange.
But this actually is, in some sense, it's an opening for reform, because in order to protect the brand,
mm-hmm.
firms can be humiliated into taking steps to protect it.
And that happened with a place like Nike, didn't it?
In part. Nike has been better at the PR part of the process than the reform part
really?
Of the process, as has Apple. But the constant targeting of Nike by a variety of activists did force them to be somewhat more transparent in their sourcing and in their monitoring.
Thank you, Julie, very much for your interesting call. Let's go to Diane in Menominee Falls. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. The thing that I don't understand, and I think that the sweatshop concept is terrible, that these people are being underpaid, but what I continually fail to understand is if there's a brand of jeans that I like and the retail price is $40, and if they're making hundreds and thousands of these every day, every week, every month at the sweatshops, and they're only paying the people $35 or $40 a month, where is the money going? Obviously, somebody's making huge profits on this, and I understand, you know, the store has to make a profit to have it in the store. There are shipping costs. There are material costs, but still, if the worker is only earning $35, $40 a month, the finished product only costs $40 itself, who is making the hundreds of thousands of dollars and just pocketing it? I still think that in the system that we have now, and it's a brand name pair of jeans that I buy, it's Gloria Vanderbilt, and the sticker price is $40 on it. I still think there's money in the current system for the worker to have without raising prices, without changing anything? Isn't it just that somebody is reaping millions of dollars of profits on this, and it's the poor worker, the uneducated worker, the skilled worker, but the uneducated worker who is paying the price?
Robert.
So your caller identifies an important problem, and that is the markups all along the commodity chain. The direct producers, the sewers and cutters and trimmers and pressers, are earning 1 to 3% of the retail price. When it goes out of the factory door, the factory owner is getting between 10 and 20% of the retail price. The largest single input cost is textile, by the way. Then it goes through a series of hands. The people, remember I mentioned that the brand will go to some intermediary. They'll go to Hong Kong and say they go to a firm called Li and Fung, 28,000 employees.
Whoa!
5,000 factories that they source to, 7,000 customers that they send stuff to. So a brand will go to Li and Fung and say, find us a factory for these jeans. And Li and Fung will find the low-priced combination of textile, twine, sewing, and packaging, and they, all these things may take place in different places. Li and Fung will put that package together for Brand X, and it's highly competitive. Li and Fung's got all these 5,000-plus factories that they source from, and they'll get them on the phone and say, how much will you make this for? So it's very cutthroat. In the meantime, Li and Fung is making money on their intermediary services. By the time it gets to the back door of the retail store, it's gone up, it's about doubled, and it's going to double again when it goes out the front door with the to the retail consumer. The profits in the system are as follows. The factory owner makes a substantial profit. There aren't any poor factory owners in Bangladesh. There are factory owners who are hustling really hard and may have a bad season or two, but the fact of the matter is, although they're only getting a minor fraction of the retail cost, they're doing it hundreds of thousands of volume, so they're making money. Li and Fung is a tremendously profitable business. It literally earns billions in profits annually. And then we come to the retail stores. They make a lot of money, of course. Walmart, of course, is the second largest corporation in the United States, the largest retailer in the world. And one of the ways that it makes a lot of money is by being extremely efficient with the very high application of information technology, so that its overhead, the back door to the front door, is much lower than its competitors. And that's one of the reasons it beats everybody on price. A, it squeezes the factory and gets the lowest price possible. And B, it has very efficient inside-the-box operations driven by information technology. So the retailers, back to your caller, the retailers do make a lot of money, but some of them are more successful than others. Sometimes they get stuck with bad real estate decisions. That is, they're in locations that should have been chosen with more care than maybe they did, and logistics problems as well. But in fact, it is a prosperous sector, and it's a prosperous business despite some ups and downs of this or that chain.
And Robert, Li and Fung would be more likely to send work to Bangladesh. How much would go there simply because my understanding is that it's the cheapest labor on the planet right now?
Yes, I. It is, according to World Bank studies that go back to 2010. And Kathleen, in preparation for something I'm writing and for your show, I prepared a chart for myself of the cost per unit of imported clothing in the United States from 1989 to 2012, and it's inflation corrected. And it's Bangladesh is the lowest in the world, although China right now is actually very close. Intentions to the contrary notwithstanding, that cost per unit of clothing corrected for inflation is now lower than it was in 1990.
Oh my goodness, isn't that amazing?
And furthermore, you know, I'm not running for elected office, so I don't have to promise pie in the sky or a second chicken in every pot or whatever. I'll tell you this. Americans are spending less on clothing now than they did a generation ago. I'd love if you have the patience for it to give you just an example of this. In 2011, the average household spent 2.8% of its expenditures on clothing. In 1984, that was 6.2%. For the people in the middle 20%, in 1984 it was 7.4%, and in 2011 it was 3.2%.
Isn't that fascinating?
So the fact of the matter is, clothes relative to rent and gasoline and health care has gotten cheaper.
Yeah. Can you send us, I don't know what kind of fashion you've got it in, on little pieces of paper or typed up or whatever, but if you could send us that graph at some point, we'll post it on our Facebook page. So I would be fascinated to see that.
Yes, I can send you a PowerPoint slide with the cost per unit.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. We'll do that. We'll put it on Facebook. All right. 800-486-8655 is our number. Robert Ross is our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. He's a professor of sociology at Clark University, author of Slaves to Fashion. We are talking, the conversation prompted by this decision by U.S. retailers, almost all of them, to back out of the Bangladesh safety agreement after the tragic factory collapse that killed over 1,100 workers. Why did they do that? This is obviously a global problem and needs, our guess says, a global agreement. We seem to be pretty far from that. So we're getting your response. Here's an email, Robert, that's come in. If anybody has organized an online boycott against U.S. retailers which are not cooperating with efforts to improve overseas clothing manufacturing facilities?
I don't know of any such. I do know that various activist groups are calling on people to communicate in whatever way they can, especially to Walmart and The Gap, to sign on to this agreement. Writing, talking to store managers. Here in my part of the country, there's a weekly vigil outside the Gap store in Harvard Square.
Really?
Yes. I think that's good behavior. I am not aware of any call for a boycott of those stores. Kathleen, I do want. Am I correct that you are headquartered in Milwaukee?
Yes, we are.
So,
our headquarters is in Madison, but we have a facility in Milwaukee, and I am in Milwaukee.
I see. Well, good for you. I have a good thing to say about Milwaukee.
Good.
the city of Milwaukee is a member of something called the Sweat-Free Purchasing Consortium. That consortium is a group of 19 public entities, three states and 16 cities, including Milwaukee and Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and some other places, who not only have laws or executive orders, in city case it would be an ordinance, saying that their purchases should, wherever possible, be, quote, sweat-free, and there are numerous places that have done that, but Milwaukee has taken the other step of joining this consortium to share information. There's a database about factories, to promulgate model codes and such like. Your listeners can look this up just by Googling sweat-free, and they'll get to sweatfree.org, which is the consortium website. Full disclosure, I'm an elected member of the board of directors. It has public members, public entity members, and labor expert members. I'm one of the labor expert members of the board.
All right. Thank you for the info. Tim is next in Mauston. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually just have a short comment. I was just recently in Winona, Minnesota, and I went to the National Eagle Center. Did the tour and everything, and I went to their merchandise store, and I couldn't find a single T-shirt that was made in America. And this is the National Eagle Center. So it just sort of seemed backwards. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Tim.
What is the National Eagle Center?
Tim, are you still there?
About 94% to 96% of our clothing consumption is imported, so I'm not surprised by your caller's experience. I've had similar shocking experience. I went to the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian and found clothing there. This is back a few years when it first opened, and I found there clothing from what was then called Burma, which was on it's now Myanmar, which was on the State Department's no-buy list because of slave labor. I said, wait a minute. So it's unfortunate, but true. And it's also the case that groups, if this National Eagle Center is Eagle Scouts or a...
I assume it's the bird. I don't know what it is, the bird.
Okay.
The bird.
So if it's run by an association, they can get wholesale union-made and environmentally friendly logo material that is ethically made. Among the groups, enterprises that do this for profit is something called Ethics Merch, E-T-H-I-X-M-E-R-C-H. You can Google that up. The CEO is a guy named Kevin O'Brien, and they will find ethically made goods. They're only wholesalers, though. I think the smallest lot is 4 dozen. Again, full disclosure, 3 or 4 years ago, I did a few months of consulting with Kevin O'Brien. I think highly of his ethical firm.
Hmm. We'll talk more about the ethics of all of this in a moment, and if people have to be doing fairly well financially themselves in order to be ethical, because times are not great for a lot of American workers. So can you be ethical when you're poor or your income is not where you would like it to be, where you're trying to stretch to make ends meet? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Robert Ross is our guest, professor of sociology at Clark University, author of Slaves to Fashion. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program on this Wednesday. You probably heard about this case last week, Russian authorities ordering a U.S. embassy employee accused of spying in Moscow out of their country, although this case is kind of shady in some ways. The Russians may have been using it to make some kind of point. It got us thinking about other famous spy cases in the history of espionage, which is pretty fascinating. We will have with us the executive director of the International Spy Spy Museum, which is based in Washington, D.C., and has exhibits that go way back to George Washington, and also Caitlin Dixon, who's a reporter and researcher for the Daily Beast. They did a list of the 10 most interesting spy cases in history. So that's coming up hour two of our show. Joan is next in Milwaukee. Hi.
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 I'm really kind of upset. I think you need to get a longer program on this sometime.
Well,
I think we have enough statistics for a while. A long time ago, maybe 20 years ago, a lady named Therese Agnew was onto this and was making an art piece out of labels from clothes from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not new. I have resolved that I will never buy another new piece of clothing. I will do all my shopping at used stores, and if I want to look for a certain brand, that's a good way to keep me from buying too much. I'll just go in and look for a name brand and recycle it.
All right, Joan, your phone is terrible, but we're hearing what you're saying. It is not new. What do you think of her solution?
Well, from the point of view of the cutters and sewers and pressers and trimmers of the world, whose interests I am most concerned about, that's not a very satisfactory solution. They need the work.
Right. Well, and it brings to mind just some very basic ethical questions about how we live and how everybody should be able to live, doesn't it, Robert Ross? And I don't know how you cannot think about somebody dying in a factory collapse when they knew the building was awful and they were beaten to go into the building. And then a couple hours, an hour after they get there, over 1,100 people are killed. And the clothing that they were making is coming to us and to European countries. I mean, how can you not stop in your tracks and say, I got to figure this out because people shouldn't die because they're making clothing?
You know, Kathleen, when I was doing this research on the fires that I mentioned at the top of the show, I would search in various databases year by year, and it was in Bangladesh that I was doing the work, or about Bangladesh. And as I created a database of fires, I had to stop every couple of weeks. I would leave it aside for months at a time because it was killing me.
Oh.
So repetitive.
Mm.
And finally, I stopped doing it, and some NGOs finished the work and put out a wonderful report called Deadly Secrets, which your listeners can find. Deadly Secrets, the fires in Bangladesh. But so I'm hearing you, and I hearing the previous caller. And yet, let me suggest that there are two different ways that people who feel these matters intensely might respond. On the one hand, there is the turning inward and asking oneself, how can I be purified from contamination of this terrible stuff? That's view A. View B. How can I make a change mm-hmm. in these conditions? They are not the same. I know of no way as an individual atom consumer to make a big effect. But as a member, for example, as a citizen of Milwaukee, we can try to help our city leverage its hundreds of thousands. I don't actually know what Milwaukee's uniform purchases are. Leverage their purchases to try to improve conditions in the industry. College students have created a whole sweat-free campus movement trying to get universities to purchase logo gear from sweat-free sources. That concept is the concept of the collective consumer acting together.
Mm-hmm.
There's another aspect of that, and that's strategic. I'm going to be going to the beach with my grandchildren and children later in July, and I want to get a white shirt cover up when I'm on the beach. I'm going to go to some sporting goods store or whatever to get something appropriate. And I'm not going to look terribly deeply into the sourcing of that for reasons I previously said. But, on the other hand, I am going to let Walmart know that I'm not going to look there because I want them to act on this international agreement. That is to say, I can be focused and respond to events as ongoing. This is a strategic question now. This international agreement is the most promising development since I began working on this matter in 1994-95.
Really? That says a lot.
Yes. No set of retailers have signed a binding agreement until now. And right now, enough of them have signed on, so it's way more than 20% of Bangladesh's factories are covered. So we're actually getting some market penetration in Bangladesh. This is a big deal. And if we could get the big North Americans to sign on to it, it would even be a bigger deal. It could become a model for work elsewhere in the country. So I think it's important. I mentioned that we've got these, my wife and I have these wonderful, darling grandsons.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to communicate to the Gap that our purchases from Baby Gap are pending their behavior. But rather than imagine that I can walk on water, because I know it's only been reported once, rather than that, I am going to try to see myself and hopefully your callers as agents of change rather than attempt to somehow purify myself, which is not in the cards.
Yeah. Let's go to a couple more calls if we can. Joan, thanks for the call. John is next. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
All right. How are you?
Good. So I was just responding to the Bangladesh sweat factories and Walmart and all that. You know, the majority of people that buy things from Walmart are lower income and middle income. And, you know, you can go to Walmart and get a jersey for $20. You go to a retail store and try to find a jersey the same quality. You know, you're paying over $100. The fact of the matter is that, you know, people are looking at it like, you know, can I buy two jerseys for my kid here for Christmas, or I need to just buy one? You know, I mean, and the fact of the matter is people have heard about this sweatshop deal, but they're still going to buy the jerseys if they can buy them cheaper. I mean, people in there's a bar in Eau Claire, they get their jerseys for $17, sell them for $35, and they can't keep them on the shelf. I don't think very many people look at the tags, or, you know, they've heard about the incident, but they go, hey, I got to put clothes on my kids.
So, you know, I think you're absolutely right, John. What do you do about that? People's incomes aren't keeping up with the cost of living, so how do you handle that, Robert?
Well, this is a vicious cycle. As a matter of fact, people have written about this. It's called the Walmart effect. You hire people at Walmart wages, and then all they can do is afford to buy at Walmart. When we look at everybody but the top 20% of the population, incomes are stagnant over 20 years. That's the problem your caller is reporting is the emerging two-humped camel in our society. That is, one hump is high-income people who have garnered all of the gains of the last decade and more. And the other hump is the middle and lower income people who have had either losses or no gains in this entire period and nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I teach about the one hump camel and the two hump camel. I appreciate very much your caller's response, and I don't mean to retreat into mere rhetoric. But I began my studies of the sweatshop problem because I was a son of a garment cutter, and I was concerned that my dad's industry, for which decency was possible in the middle of the 20th century, had become a sweatshop industry at home. And then I inquired as to why. What's going on? And this whole global system revealed itself. The point is the relationship here. If American workers were able to keep up in income...
We have about 5 seconds.
Then this, these pennies that Walmart saves us would not be so important. In that regard, our concerns and our struggles as people here in the United States are actually linked.
Right. All right. Robert, thank you ever so much. Send us that PowerPoint. We'll put it on our Facebook page, and we'll talk to you again. Robert Ross, author of Slaves to Fashion, our guest. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show and to KP for doing on-air production. We'll be back.